Bum ba dee da da dee, da da dee, bum bum bum. Dum dee dum bum, bum 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 ba.
Why, that's a pretty low note there, Brother
that's
Bing.
That's down there, Tony. You know, that's where the money is down there. Sure, you got to reach down for the money.
Well, let's get up out of this vocal mine shaft.
Mm-hmm.
You've become about as famous as an entertainer can become, and yet you don't claim to be a great entertainer.
Oh, no, I'm not, Tony. If you look at what I've done, there's really nothing outstanding there to reflect about. No great performances. I have just an ordinary voice. Probably have a little style that distinguishes my singing from other people who sing. And it seems to be a style that is acceptable, and I think the reason for its acceptance is that I think pretty near everybody who has an ear for music at all that can carry a tune feels that really he could sing as good as I do if he was given an opportunity, and candidly, I think he's darn near right.
You also don't claim to be a great actor, but you have an Academy Award for acting.
Well, that was because it was a charming picture, and it was a charming role, well written by Leo McCarey and beautifully directed, but there wasn't any acting in the role either. I just played Bing Crosby. And it was a war year. Everybody was away at war, and I just kind of snuck in and won the Oscar for that. I don't want to be wallowing in humility or anything, Tony. I'm just trying to be truthful. I'm just trying to express, you know, the way I feel.
Yes, but the point is that you've become famous, exceedingly famous. Does this have a sort of a burden? Do you feel a weight around your shoulders?
No, heavens no. As I said, I think it's possibly because I have sort of a common touch, and that's not anything that I've tried to achieve. I've not sought the common touch, but I go where I like to go, and I meet the kind of people I like to meet, and it happens to be a wide, wide cross-section of human beings. I'm friendly with jockeys, caddies, touts, gamblers, musicians, athletes from every athletic field. With I know a lot of titled people. I know a lot of statesmen, a lot of politicians. I think I probably have more of a cross-section of acquaintanceship than anybody I can think of, and that's not anything that I went out to do. It's just that those kind of people entertain me, and I have a good time with them, and I wouldn't want to be always with any one group, but I like them all.
Well, let's go back a long, long way. Here's the first record you ever made in Los Angeles in 1926 with Don Clark's orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
I've Got the Girl.
Yes, that was done with Al Rinker. We'd come down here from Spokane, Washington, down to Los Angeles, and Don Clark had the orchestra at the Biltmore Hotel, and we were singing around some nightclubs here, and he heard us, and that was recorded in a warehouse down 6th and Bixel, which is now CBS Radio, I believe, and it was a warehouse at that time, and the orchestra was set up there among the packing cases, and we stepped out and sang our little chorus. I got the girl, I got the girl. Doom de doo doom de doo doom de doo doom de doo doom doom doom. Ta da ti doo, ta da ti doo, bang.
You recall that session?
That was the great epic first.
Well, now, the first solo that you did, to my knowledge, was done on March 7th of 1927 with Paul Whiteman, and the song was Still Around, Muddy Water.
That's right. That was done down at Camden, New Jersey. In those days, when you recorded for Victor, you had to go down to Camden to record. That was their principal place of business. That's where all their factories were. And if you were going to record for Victor, you went down there and had to live at Atlantic City, which we didn't mind. And we spent about a week there making records, and I was in a vocal group humming and oohing and awing and noodling, and they did give me a solo called Muddy Waters.
Thank you.
Muddy water around my feet. Muddy water in the street. Just God's own shelter down on the Delta. Muddy water in my shoes. Rockin' to those low-down blues. They live in ease and comfort down there, I declare. Been away a year today to wander and roam. I don't care, it's muddy there, but still it's my home. Got my toes and Dixie way, round that Delta let me lay. My heart cries out for muddy water.
Well, you must have done a lot of moving around in those days, recording in L.A. in 26 and then in Camden, New Jersey in 27.
Yes, and we did have a recording date up in New York, too, for a couple of weeks' time with Whiteman in Liederkranz Hall. I suppose that's torn down now, but it was it's still there. The engineer is just giving me the nod. In those days, it was used for big orchestras, and Paul had 30 men, and we recorded about 2 weeks there. I can't remember what we recorded.
How did you come to meet Whiteman?
Well, I was playing with Rinker the Metropolitan Theater here in Los Angeles. Paul and his orchestra were playing the Million Dollar Theater down the street. And we'd had a substantial success around here, and we're doing well at the Metropolitan Theater. And he came up to hear us and sent for us, and we went down and had a chat with him in his dressing room, and his band left at the end of the week. And when we'd finished up our contractual commitments in the area, why, we joined him in Chicago at the Tivoli Theater, 63rd and Cottage Grove.
Bing, you're considered to be one of the first crooners. But some of these early discs sound as if you're belting them out.
I don't know about that title, crooner. In those days, it was more or less a term applied to anybody that sang popular songs. Ballet really preceded me. He did sing rather soft, I think. He probably was more a legitimate crooner than I was, but I was so described. I don't think it was a term of opprobrium, but it was just a categorization. Wow.
Bing, apparently you and the Rhythm Boys didn't take life or your jobs too seriously in those days.
No, we were young, impulsive, and liked the nightclubs, and crazy about music and about bands. And we spent a lot of time in Harlem at the Cotton Club, where Duke Ellington held forth, and where Ethel Waters was singing then, and later Lena Horne, and all the great singers, and of course there were several other clubs around Harlem where you could hear good hot music, jazz music, and we were nuts about it, and so kept us up late some evenings. Yeah, we got around a bit and had a lot of fun. I don't think we were really too serious about our work. It was just something we liked to do, and we enjoyed it, and never really made a conscious effort to improve ourselves, although we looked for new material all the time, but it was difficult to get all three of us together at one time for a rehearsal. About the only time we did is when Whiteman had something for us to do with the big band, and then we had to be there or we'd get the old sack.
Now, despite this relaxed, easygoing image that you present to the world, it seems that you're a little bit more rambunctious than that as a boy. Or am I presuming too much?
You mean as a boy before I started working, Tony?
Yeah,
or
a cut-up.
Oh, I was in a bit of trouble now and then, just about the same amount that any youngster would be in who had an active imagination and an Irish heritage.
Playing hooky?
Oh, a lot of that. That was one of my lesser sins.
Yeah?
But I might raid an icebox now and then, or rob a bakery wagon, or a few little things. I was several times in durance vile with the juvenile authorities. Those, you know, remember in the old days, they used to make homemade ice cream, you know, and they'd leave it out on the back porch after they'd ground it a while with the rock salt. Well, we lifted many an ice cream freezer. We've always brought the freezer back, though.
That was decent of you.
Sans creme.
And then you always had this angelic look on your face, those blue eyes looking up at the judge in juvenile court.
It fooled everybody but my mother. Last time I got involved was a bakery wagon we heisted, and they took us down to the pokey and called my mother. She said, just leave him there. So I cooled my heels there for a day or two. They want her to come and get me, but she says it'll be good for him. Just leave him there.
She administered the corporal punishment, not your dad.
No, Dad never licked any of us. He was a jolly one.
You mentioned the Irish background. Didn't your grandparents come directly from Ireland to Canada?
That's right. They came to an area somewhere. Is there a River Miramichi?
Yeah.
You know of it? Well, it's in that area. And then they moved to Cloquet, Minnesota, and then out to Tacoma, Washington, where my mother met my father.
You know, you start off your book, Call Me Lucky, with an anecdote about your mother on her deathbed.
My grandmother, yes. That was... she was, you know, feeling her last hours approaching, and her husband, Dennis, was sitting beside her bed, and she said, "Dennis, give me your hand." And he took her hand, and he said, "Ah, Katie, it was a hand that was never raised against you." And she says, "It's a damn good thing for you it wasn't, too."
A little bit of that spirit is rubbed off on you, I think.
I don't know.
Well, I understand that you were studying law, and you liked elocution and debating.
I was on the debating team, and I participated every year in the elocution contest. You know, the Jesuits are great for public speaking and for debating societies and for elocution, and that was stressed very heavily in the education that I got at Gonzaga University. 8 years of it there, 4 years high school and 4 years college.
Well, this was very helpful in phrasing songs.
You think my diction's good, Tony?
I think your diction's awfully good.
Not crisp and clipped like yours, like a Canadien.
I don't think that the kids today are as concerned with elocution and debating and that kind of thing as they were, you know, 30 years ago.
Probably not. It's not a good thing for them to miss it. They should really get back to it. Some of these youngsters, you know, that have achieved this overnight success are 16, 17 years old, and they really haven't had time to learn anything about public speaking or enunciation or diction or projection or delivery. And when they go to the actors' workshop in New York, is that where Brando and those fellows went? Well, they teach them to mumble and grumble and throw their lines down in the floor and down their beard. So they're not going to get any articulateness there.
They also seem to consider it rather square to
be articulate.
Well.
Yeah, well, that's true. You brought up a good point there.
But your own singing was well-announced and well-phrased. Haven't you once said that the secret of your singing was phrasing?
Phrasing, yes. I believe that if it has any aspect that you can pick out and point to, that would be it, yeah. I don't remember ever singing a song by notes. I just kind of read the song and let the melody come along or wherever I found it, you know. Read the words, rather. You'd call it a reading of words with the musical delivery. That's pretty vague, isn't it? Have to have a chart to draw that up.
Let's touch on the history again. In 1930, you and the entire Whiteman outfit came to Hollywood to do a picture called The King of Jazz, in which you were supposed to sing The Song of the Dawn, but it turned out that you didn't sing The Song of the Dawn. In the picture, John Bull sang it.
That's right.
Now, why?
Well, I was booked to sing it, Tony, and it was a long picture. I had a long schedule. We were out here for several months, and had some holidays and celebrations, and one time I got a little juiced, should we say, and got involved in a bit of a traffic mishap involving another automobile, and it was clear that I'd been drinking, and the judge, of course we had prohibition in those days, asked me if I had been drinking. I said, "Yes, but everybody does a little these days." He said, "Well, haven't you heard about the prohibition statute?" And I said, "Oh, of course, but nobody pays much attention to it." He said, "Well, you'll have 30 days to think about it and pay some attention to it." And clang went the door, and there I was for 30 days, and the song I was to do, The Song of the Dawn, in the picture, which was my big moment, was done by John Bowles, and done very well, too, I might add. Probably a lot better than I would have done it anyhow.
Who would you say had the greatest influence on your style as a singer?
I think Jolson, probably, near as I can tell. I always had Jolson records around the house when I was a kid, and I saw him in musical comedies twice when they came through Spokane, touring companies of Sinbad the Sailor, I believe it was, and Bombo. He was an idol of mine. I think I unconsciously adopted some of his mannerisms, vocal mannerisms.
He was Mr. Show Business of an earlier era.
The greatest entertainer that ever lived, I think.
Now, when Jolie made a comeback, he did a lot of radio work with you.
Yes, we did, I would say 15 or 20 straight shows for the Kraft Music Hall with Jolie. Had him on regularly.
When Jolie made that big comeback, his voice seemed to be even better than what it was before.
He was amazing. His range was fantastic, even in after his comeback. And he sang, his intonation was just as good as it ever was. He could go way up high and take a soft note or belt it, and he could go way down. He really had a fabulous set of pipes, this fella.
I wonder if you get a little tired of people like myself, always shoving you back into the past, too much reflection on what has gone behind.
Oh, no, I'm a gabby old character, Tony, and I like to reminisce. This is very amusing for me.
Well, you know, I think the fan is more inclined to be nostalgic than the performer.
Not in my case. I like to go back and ruminate about those days.
And it's always the association of the past.
Mm-hmm. I forget, unless somebody comes around and asks me and interviews me like you are now, I quite forget all these things that happened. It's nice to think about them again.
Now, your old friend Bob Hope has made constant reference to the amount of money, property, and fortune that you're supposed to have. Doesn't this get a little tiresome?
Well, you know, that's the old thing. Me thinks he protesteth too much. Tony, he's really a lot more wealthy than I am, but he seeks to throw suspicion off about himself by pointing at me. He's loaded, this guy. He's got the first dollar he ever made and the one he found. And he just keeps amassing great wealth. You know how hard he works. Well, you know that he's getting paid, and he must be the richest entertainer in show business by all odds.
Now, there's a revelation. All the jokes point to you being the richest.
He protests too much.
Now, they harp so much on this thing constantly, not only Hope, but other people, you know. If it were me, I'd get a little tired of that.
Well, no, I don't mind, but it's like anything else, Tony. It's like Phil Harris's drinking, you know, or Dean Martin's. They say Dean Martin's drunk all the time. And then it gets to be everybody believes this and thinks he is. I was up at Las Vegas not long ago where Dean was working, and sat in his dressing room an hour before the show, and he didn't have a drink, and he finally they poured a great big glass full of apple juice, and he walked out on the stage with this brown-looking liquid, and everybody thought it was bourbon, and he kept drinking all through the show, and the audience sat out there and said, "Good Lord, how can he drink that straight bourbon like that and still be on his feet?" Well, it was apple juice. It's a legend. It gets up my money, his drinking, Phil Harris is drinking. They don't drink like that. I haven't got that kind of money. Everybody that repeats the story enlarges on it, expands it, and until it becomes a legend.
Getting back to Hope, is he the closest personal friend that we assume him to be?
Yes, indeed. We are very, very close. Our families and he and I, too.
Well, you're the casual, easygoing one. He is on the go all the time.
He certainly is. I am at loss to describe where he gets this fountain of energy. It's indescribable. Of course, he thrives on it. When he isn't working, he's unhappy, unless it's playing golf. He does love golf, and outside of golf and work, I don't know anything else that he does.
Does he ever alight at one spot for one day?
Very seldom, and I can't recall hardly ever seeing him sit down in a chair, put his feet up, and just do nothing but gab. He's always bang, bang, telephone, this guy, that guy, calling him, coming to see him. On the golf course, though, he does relax and enjoy himself.
You ever try and persuade him to take a quiet vacation somewhere?
Oh, I did once, yeah. I told him he ought to go to the Argentine. I said, "You need a rest." So he went down there. He came back. He had hives, shingles, and a spastic colon. He excoriated me. He says, you damn near got me killed. He said, "I'll never take another vacation."
Bing, you once said this about yourself. "With the exception of a phonograph record or two, I don't think I've done anything really worthwhile."
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's modest, but it takes some explaining.
I mean, I don't think I've done anything great or fantastically good. I've done some things that are worthwhile. It'd be kind of ridiculous for me to say that I haven't, but no more than worthwhile. I can't sing the things that I hear other fellows sing that are so great. My acting, I play Bing Crosby every picture. I do think I can handle light comedy pretty well. At least I hear people laughing at things that I say when I'm working either on the screen or on television or in benefits or in vaudeville. And I think that's about the extent of it. I like to be realistic and not kid myself, and I think you're happier if you do. Tony, people ask me why I don't quit, why I don't retire, and I suppose my attorney, Jack O'Melveny, and my friend for many, many years has got the answer. It's because I love to sing too much. It's because I love show business and people that I've had an opportunity to meet in show business. It's an exciting life. I love music. I love working with fine orchestras and with clever and talented people who you meet and with whom you're associated when you're making pictures. But I suppose I'd be much happier if I weren't doing it, because I'm not a great actor. I'll never be one. I'm confident I'll never create anything be of lasting importance. So really, no matter what I've done to date or no matter what I'm likely to do, there's not going to be any promise that I can see of any great artistic satisfaction. The satisfaction, for instance, that Olivier gets out of the things he's done, or Guinness, or some of the great writers, both of music and of literature. That must be, to me, a great satisfaction to know that they've written or composed something that's going to be timeless. As far as I'm concerned, with the exception of a phonograph record or two, I don't think I've ever done anything that's really outstanding or great or marvelous or anything that deserves any superlatives.
But if you don't have tremendous admiration and respect, you have millions of people looking at you with lots of affection.
Oh, I think people just say, he's a pretty nice guy. He's just like Joe down the block there.
Yeah.
You know, there's no side to him, no swank, or no... he's not uppish or snobbish. That's probably what they like about me.
Well, anybody age 30 and above has sort of grown up with you singing in the airwaves.
Yeah, I've been around all those years, for sure, Tony.
But this is affection, and this must be a satisfaction for you.
It sure is. It's a great satisfaction to know I have those kind of friends.
Tell me, would you rather step out of the business right now?
I don't think I could entirely, Tony. I've got a deep affection for the business and for the people in it. And even when I just finished 6 weeks up in Northern California hunting and fishing, a ranch I have up there near Mount Shasta, and... wouldn't the day go by that I didn't read the trade papers and the Daily Reporter and the Variety and find out what's going on. And it's an interest that you never lose, and I'll certainly never lose it.